Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In journalism, there are the five W's, who, what, when, where, and the most important W, who's going to pay for this? We look at the economics of investigative reporting. How does the market transform muckraking information into a sustainable news product? And what happens when editors and publishers don't see the economic value of that big scoop? We're joined by the author of the new book, Democracy's Detectives, The Economics of Investigative Reporting, by economist James Hamilton. And James, welcome to The Source.
Glad to be here.
The economics of investigative journalism, we got a sample of that. There's a recent movie, a hit movie that came out, Spotlight.
I know there's things you cannot tell me, but I also know there's a story here, and I think everybody will hear about it.
Do you think your paper has the resources to take that on?
I do. Do you?
The Boston priests molested kids in six different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing. We haven't committed any long-term investigative resources to the case.
No, we haven't.
And that's the kind of thing your team would do.
Spotlight?
Guys, listen. Everybody's going to be interested in this.
Spotlight.
Just the tip line.
You think he's got something?
I want to keep digging.
We need to focus on the institution. Show me that it came from the top down.
The resources. They kept talking about, where's the resources for this investigation? Are there enough in order to challenge the Catholic Church in this instance? And you look at the resources, James, and the cost of investigative reporting versus the benefit for society and also for the institution producing the journalism. And how does that weigh out?
Well, if you think about investigative reporting, it's original content about a topic of substantive interest to the community that somebody wants to keep secret. And in economic terms, original content means you have to invest money to find out the facts, to discover the story. When you tell the story, it can change public policies, but it's hard for you to get the full benefit of that. It's hard for you to monetize it. And then when you think about the government trying to keep documents and data hidden, that raises the hassle cost of telling the story. So one of the conundrums, and it's why I entitled the book Democracy's Detectives, is who's going to hire the detective? Democracy is not a person. So we have to figure out how you get stories that would clearly pass a social cost-benefit test. And in my book, I actually take three stories and do a benefit-cost analysis of them. So you have stories that would clearly benefit society, but they're hard to tell because they don't always pass a market test.
And the market test would be, if I am the editor or the news director, do I have the ability to take one reporter, at least one reporter, and move them out of the daily news flow to work on big stories? And when they do that, will those stories actually help my bottom line at the end of the quarter? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly. And in my book, I look at, over a period of 30 years, stories that were submitted to the Investigative Reporters and Editors Prize Contest. And I find that, on average, those stories took about 6 months. So it can be a major investment. And in one of the case studies that I do, I look at the Raleigh News and Observer, where they took 6 months to investigate the probation series in North Carolina. What they found was, from 2000 to 2008, 580 people had been murdered in North Carolina by people out on probation. That was a fact that had never been surfaced before, and that series caused laws to change in North Carolina, caused more expenditures on the probation system, and I estimate that in the first year that policies changed, 8 fewer people were murdered by folks out on probation. But that's something that people in the Triangle area didn't realize when it was happening. Nobody walks out of the house and says, thank goodness, News and Observer, I have a lower probability of being murdered today. So newspapers generate tremendous benefits to society, but sometimes it's hard for them to monetize it. There is some financial return, though. If you think about the brand that you can establish for offering a different story, offering a story that can't be found somewhere else, that's a long-term brand, and I find in my book that there are some chains and publishers which have a consistent long-term brand for telling stories that that you can't find at other places.
Because journalism is an experiential product. You can't try it on and then say, oh, I don't like it, I won't put it out. When you experience it, that's how you consume the product, and people will have to go by your reputation as a scoop maker, as a newsbreaker, so they say, I'm going to spend time watching this channel versus this channel, or reading this newspaper versus another.
That's exactly right. Information products like newspaper articles or like television programs, you don't really know what's inside until you consume it. So how do we get you to consume it? Maybe we use the same person telling the story day by day. So if I said Rachel Maddow, Anderson Cooper, Bill O'Reilly, you might have different images in your mind of the type of story that might be told. And if I tell you that one site often rewrites or repurposes information from many other sites, you might say, that's the Huffington Post. And if I tell you that there's a site that has over 1,000 journalists producing high-quality stories about many different countries, you might say, thank you, New York Times. So establishing the brand can be definitely related to telling stories like investigative stories.
I was going to say thank you, NPR, but okay, New York Times.
Yes, well, actually, in my book, one of the things I look at is radio investigative stories, and I find that radio investigative stories were more likely to do topics not covered well in other media, including stories about injustice and inequality. So there are distinctive things that nonprofit media do. And one of the interesting things about nonprofit media, over the last 5 years, there's been a big push towards trying to describe the impact of their work. If you look at ProPublica, one of the things that they do, they have about 30 reporters. They've won several Pulitzer Prizes. And they try to take on stories where they believe they can make a difference. They keep telling the story, keep generating new stories on a topic until they see policy change. And it's not advocacy in the sense that they don't start with an answer and then try to assemble facts. They start with a problem, and then they try to assemble a set of stories that might help people, including policymakers, reason their way through to a solution.
But the issue is, how do you make this sustainable? You know, ProPublica is a nonprofit, and they give their journalism away. You don't have to buy it, and they want it run in newspapers all over the country. And also the same with the Texas Tribune that you read about in your book, Democracy's Detectives, The Economics of Investigative Journalism. We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. We'll talk about, how does this create bias in the media, you know, and how do we, what are the economics of news filters that you put into and information markets? This all adds up to whether or not you're going to get the information that you need, consumers need, in order to make big decisions about democracy and what happens when we don't have that. Does this effective way of weaponizing democracy by keeping the people ignorant? Anyway, call in. We want to hear what your take on this is. The number is 210-614-8980. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Investigative journalism has had a real impact on the real world. You know, $1 invested into a story can generate hundreds of dollars in social benefits. But the people who write the checks for the newspaper or the TV station, the radio station, if they don't see that benefit, how are they going to be able to sustain having an investigative reporting team or even just one reporter on staff? We're talking about Democracy's Detectives, The Economics of Investigative Journalism. And we're speaking with the economist James T. Hamilton. And James, you've looked at the economics of news quite a bit. And one question that you looked at was, why is local TV news so bad?
Yes, that is consistent if you look across the country. In part, it relates to the radius of the audience, the set of people who are watching. If you think about the New York Times, they can aggregate up the attention of college-educated people around the country and increasingly around the world, and they can do a deep investigative dive and spread the cost of that across many different people. If you think about the challenge faced by a local television station, what they have to figure out is, in a very competitive market, because you often have three or four other people offering local news, what can they do in terms of making an investigation? And what I find in the book is that local TV does do investigative reporting, but because of the limits on their resources, they are more likely to tell you the story about the bad doctor than the bad hospital or the bad hospital system. So they're more likely to frame a story around an individual rather than an institution. And one of the challenges is how can you figure out supporting the stories that hold institutions accountable? I will say one other thing about local TV. I wrote a book called Channeling Violence, which was about the market for violent television programming. And I found that within each market in the U.S., there's often a high-violence station and a low-violence station. They deal with the same reality, but there's product differentiation. So the high-violence station talks to you about crime, disasters, and accidents, and the low-violence station talks to you about state government and education policy.
So the if it bleeds, it leads station versus one that would wonder, that will look at the legislation going on in Austin instead.
That's right. And if it bleeds, it leads, I found when I was looking at it, one out of three stories was about crime. One out of three crime stories was about murder. And probably the station that I looked at the time that was offering the most television violence in their local news was WSVN in Miami. Over the course of 1 month, they showed 20 different corpses in their stories, and their competitors were only showing one or two. And the way they generated that was that if there wasn't a murder in Miami, they would bring in coverage from a satellite from another city. So we don't tend to think about news as an economic product, but it really is. It's driven by a set of economic supply and demand factors.
When I was a local TV news producer, I was told, don't lead a newscast with anything other than we had to have the police lights in the first story. If it didn't have those lights in it, then it wasn't a story, wasn't a lead story, no matter what the content was. So how might the media be biased? How do economic factors lead to that?
So it's interesting. Objectivity is really a commercial product in the United States. What I found in a book I wrote called All the News That's Fit to Sell is that if you look at newspapers, objective nonpartisan newspapers came about in the U.S. around 1870 when high-speed presses were invented, and they were very costly. And the way that you spread the cost of that press across many people is you took the word Democrat or Republican out of the title of your newspaper, and you became an independent newspaper. So when you were in a world of very high cost, what you had was a desire to be objective because you could spread that cost across many different people. If you fast forward to today, the cost of running an internet site is relatively low. You have much more niche audiences. And in a way, media bias is, again, like product differentiation. What I found is that if you ask somebody to put themselves on a 7-point scale where 1 is liberal and 7 is conservative, after they put themselves on that scale, I can ask them if a particular media product is, in their mind, biased, and I can predict their answer based on the average ideology of the person who consumes that media product. So liberal will say Fox is biased, and a conservative will say MSNBC is biased, and an economist will say that's product differentiation.
But will investigative reporting, just picking your topics, you know, they say news is where you look. So if they want to do a sort of Project Veritas type of dive into an organization, that's going to be an organization that is, you know, I am, opposed to because and try and call it news. So is that investigative reporting?
So investigative reporting is original content about issues of substantive interest to the community that somebody wants to keep secret. And sometimes it could be done by an advocacy group. And if it's fact-based, I think that the incentive that created it might not be as important as what's discovered. So I think there are five incentives that generate information. Pay me, that's subscription. I want to sell your attention, that's advertising. I want to change how you think about the world, that's nonprofit, that could be NPR. I want your vote, that's partisan, and I just like to talk, that's expression. And so if we look at the mix of stories that we're seeing generated now, we're seeing different emphasis on each of these five different incentives. If you go to Flint, Michigan, for instance, you'll see that the investigative story there started off by an investigative reporter funded by the ACLU, and yet the facts that he generated were then taken up and further explored by for-profit media. So really the litmus test is, if you create the information, can other people go out there and verify it and use it?
Just like good scientific data.
Exactly.
Or economic data, in the case, That's in right. your case. So, I mean, your book is full of tables and charts and algorithms. I mean, is that really part of it in figuring out what news is?
Yeah, I think that we've talked about the challenges, but I think the book, I didn't want to write another book about how things are going wrong with the media. So in the last chapter, I think it ends on a hopeful note in the following sense. I talk about some policy changes that could come about. I view real reform of the implementation of freedom of information laws as one way to lower the cost of discovering stories. I also think it would be important for the government to acknowledge that there are market failures in journalism. There are a set of folks in D.C. who believe that the public interest is defined by the public's interest. And we had a FCC commissioner famously say, TV is just a toaster with pictures. And they believe that there's nothing different about information markets. I believe that there are market failures, that when you do tell these stories, you don't get fully rewarded to the benefit you bring to society. And I think if that were acknowledged by the government, it would do two things. Number one, it would allow the IRS to more readily acknowledge that online public affairs sites should be recognized as nonprofits. There's been a difficulty in getting that done. And number two, there are all sorts of parts of the government, like the NSF, that fund R&D in algorithms. But journalism is not one of the things that they fund. I think if you funded more development of tools for reporters, it wouldn't tip the balance between newspapers or radio, and it wouldn't tip the balance between national security or environment. Those things would be content neutral and platform agnostic. What you would basically be doing is helping reporters hold the government accountable with better tools. And it's funny, the reason I say this in part is I once applied for an NSF grant using the term computational journalism. And the reviewer said, the government has great software to analyze data. And I thought they totally missed the irony. I know that the government has great software to watch me. I'd like great software to watch the government.
And looks like the government cut in right there.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now we're in. Okay, great. We got you back on. I think you said the wrong thing on the air there, James. FCC doesn't like that. Speaking of the FCC, you know, they used to have higher standards requiring public information. And now the attitude is the public's interest is whatever interests the public. That puts the TMZ at the same level of Meet the Press.
Yeah, and I think... again, if people talked about this problem of journalism as a problem of a market failure, it would attract the attention of more people to work on the problem. And one of the things that I'm heartened by at Stanford is that we're seeing more interest by computer scientists who are looking at this puzzle and saying, how can we help? Are there things that we could do? And I think that if you can develop tools that make it easier to spot stories, or if you can develop things that allow you to tell stories in more personalized or engaging ways, that's the way that you could support investigative reporting. If you think about, for instance, the Panama Papers series that just came out, they had great visualization software that allowed them to look at the connections between offshore banking accounts.
But what about the FCC taking higher standards? These are the public airwaves, and they should be doing something along those lines.
Yeah, I think if you look at the implementation of that, one of the things that you may be trying to do is require people to tell a story that they don't want to do. So if you look back at some of the implementation of those public interest requirements, you would have people who were saying, all right, you want me to tell a story? I will do a crime story that's really about gore and blood, but I'm going to call it public policy. So sometimes I think in terms of public affairs requirements and the airwaves, pay to play might be better if you were going to actually tax people or have people pay a fee that would go towards funding true journalism.
James T. Hamilton is a Hearst Professor of Communication at Stanford University. His book is Democracy's Detectives, The Economics of Investigative Journalism. James, it was great talking with you.
Thank you very much.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio.